Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm really delighted to see this crowd on this extremely wet and uninviting evening in London in the pitch darkness with terrible traffic and everything else. So well done. I congratulate myself first of all. I've probably come the furthest of all of you. But I was impelled along the road by the fact that I had the wine in my boot. So I launched this book about 10 days ago in Rome. So this is my second attempt to get it onto the water without sinking. And in fact, you can even hear my talk. It's on YouTube. I don't know how I explain how to get there, but I think I put it on my blog somewhere. And in Rome, of course, I wanted to be nice to the Italians. So I emphasized the Italian side of this book and the principal protagonist, the person behind everything else with these petitions, was this Italian lady that no one's heard of, or very few people have heard of, Christina Campo. And I really wanted to make the air ring with her name, because she's so unknown. She's such an attractive personality, and she really ought to be better known. And so I'm not going to say anything about Christina Campo this evening. And you'll have to read about her in the book. So there's an incentive for you. But this is the centenary of her birth. So I was particularly keen to get it out this year. That aspect of it, incidentally, is very much, that aspect of the book is very much in the debt of Father Gabriel Diaz, who's trying to be unobtrusive in the back row. But the three quite long chapters by him, and that is the core of the historical narrative given by the book about how the petitions came into existence. The 1966 petition, which again, not very many people have heard about, 1971 petition, which a few more people have heard about, but they've only heard half the story. So I recommend those chapters. But again, I'm not going to talk about them because I can't talk about everything. So the book is quite a disparate collection of material, and with various contributors, as well as Father Diaz and myself, we have Matthew Shellhorn, Eric Tunning, Leo Darach, Sebastian Morello, who is in fact on his way here, so he'll probably burst in halfway through my talk, and writing about different aspects of it from their own specialist knowledge. We're all working in the shadow of an earlier generation of people, however, the petitioners themselves. And there's a lot of them. So we all think there's 57 in 1971, but actually there wasn't. There was 104, at least 104. There was an overlapping group of 36, I think, in 1966. And then there were later petitions. So writing about this, we have standing behind us and interacting with the book in different aspects, their different interests and their different connections with each other. People like Evelyn Waugh, Hugh Ross Williamson, Arnold Lahn, Kathleen Rain, E.I. Watkin, Tito Cassini, and Father Brian Houghton, and of course there are, you know, on and on and on. But the ones I mentioned are mostly British. They themselves were the cultural heirs of another group of people further back in history, who we also bring in to the dialogue in the book. So Sebastian Morello has written a chapter about Joseph de Maistre, who was, you know, the great theorist of Latin as the language of the church. And then there's also a whole chapter by Marcel Proust, quite appropriate, I can never remember his name, Marcel Proust. So, which is, it's always nice to have a contribution by someone who's been dead for at least 100 years. They're very easy to work with. But I like to think of this book, in fact, like a magnificent party, though certainly not like one some of us attended yesterday evening with too many people and not enough drink stuffed into a small room, so that it was impossible to hear anyone speak. But perhaps more like a concert where each contribution can be heard, themes explored, ideas developed, and tensions resolved. In talking about the book, I have to choose which of the themes to pick out, since I certainly can't say anything helpful about them all in one evening. Lest listeners lose sight of this in the course of my presentation, let me emphasise the book, as well as what I'm going to talk about, it also contains substantial discussions of the importance of Latin, the nature of liturgical prayer, the process of liturgical reform, the history of the petitions, and other categories of petitioners, such as the circle around Evelyn Waugh, and so on. So here, in the London launch, I'm going to focus on the artists, particularly writers and musicians. What I'm going to talk about could be illustrated with reference to the Italian artists, but I haven't heard of most of these before I started writing this book, and I'm sure you'll have heard of many more of them than I have. But even so, to stay on safe ground, where we all know what we're talking about, I'm going to concentrate on the British ones. There are also a lot of Spaniards, Frenchmen, and, interestingly enough, Argentinians. Argentinians are very well represented in the petitions, for reasons which you can ask Father Gabriel about, or indeed just read his chapter in the book. So among these artists, we find many who were at the cutting edge of artistic development, innovators in what is called artistic modernism. The poets W.S. Auden and David Jones are well-known examples. Auden signed the 1966 petition and Jones the 1971 petition. The American writers, I'm not going to talk about these, but just out of interest, the poet Robert Lovell and a remarkable lady called Juna Barnes, who wrote a book called The Book of Repulsive Women. So they are in a kind of similar category. So more recently, Sir James Macmillan, who signed a petition in 2007, which is also encompassed by the book, continues this tradition. So Sir James Macmillan is a modernist musician in a musical sense. He's also a traditional Catholic. In fact, he's a patron of the Latin Mass Society. Very, very dedicated over many years to church music, to promotion of Gregorian chant, all those sorts of things. So there are many others as well. So many people will find this very strange. Why would artistic modernists be concerned about the traditional Mass, including many artists who are not even Catholic? The Trappist monk, Father Thomas Merton, in 1964, so he's well on his way into theological liberalism by this point in his life, he wrote to his superior, "This is what I think about the Latin and the chant. They are masterpieces which offer us an irreplaceable monastic and Christian experience. They have a force, an energy, a depth without equal. All the proposed English offices are very much impoverished in comparison. Besides, it is not at all impossible to make such things, Latin and chant, understood and appreciated. Generally, I succeed quite well in this, in the novitiate, with some exceptions, naturally, who do not understand well. But I must add something more serious. As you know, I have many friends in the world who are artists, poets, authors, editors, etc. Now, they are well able to appreciate our chant and even our Latin, but they are all, without exception, scandalized and grieved when I tell them that probably this office, this Mass, will no longer be here in 10 years. And that is the worst. The monks cannot understand this treasure they possess, and they throw it out to look for something else, when seculars, who, for the most part, are not even Christians, are able to love this incomparable art. So that's Thomas Merton. This needs to be explained. And indeed, I think it came to a shock to the liturgical progressives pushing the reform to find opposition coming from this quarter. I should add that the opposition to the reform by artists was very strongly felt. After signing the 1966 petition, Auden was confronted by the same movement within his own Anglican communion over the Book of Common Prayer. This man, a one-man poetic revolution, creating such a distinctive poetic voice within modernism, was aghast at the proposals. He begged one cleric, and I quote, in the bowels of Christ, unquote, not to abandon the Book of Common Prayer, and observed, and I quote, a demand for liturgical change came not from the laity, but from priests hoping to attract the young by looking trendy. Now, David Jones, an equally groundbreaking modernist poet, was equally forthright in many letters to friends and to the Catholic press. I wanted a pithy quotation from David Jones, but I'm afraid David Jones just doesn't provide pithy quotations. the best bits I could find were things that would need to be kind of heavily footnoted. So I leave it to you to read the book. I mean, he's a wonderful man. I take my word for it. He was absolutely beside himself on this subject. Why, though, did the innovating artists want to preserve the past in the form of the liturgy? It would not be so surprising to see writers like Betjeman, C.S. Lewis, or Tolkien supported, although for whatever reason, none of these individuals actually signed these petitions, because these men I've just mentioned were artistic traditionalists, at least arguably. But here we have artists of a quite different sort. This is such an important issue and so crucial to understanding the petitions that three or four chapters, depending on how you count them, consider it from slightly different angles in the book. One is by my friend Eric Tunning, an academic specialising in this area, and it is remarkably fortuitous that I attended a lecture of his on David Jones and Kafka, of all people, while this book was in the planning stages and was stimulated to ask him to contribute something to it. At this point, however, I'm going to switch over to reading an extract from the book rather than continue paraphrasing it. This is from chapter 19 by me. It starts from the idea of modernity as a crisis, a historical moment following industrialization, urbanization, mass production, mass media, and migration, some of it caused by the war, in which the old ways are overthrown and new ways are needed. So here is the rest of this, is from chapter 19. For one familiar group of modernists, the Catholic Church of that era, with all its traditions, is part of the status quo, which is in crisis and needs radical change or overthrow. The Church can take on that appearance to those completely immersed in the Church's culture and institutions. These include, first, the theological modernists of the first half of the 20th century. For them, embedded in debates about theology and biblical exegesis within Catholic universities and seminaries, and under the watchful eye of their superiors, the status quo challenged by the crisis of modernity was that of theological conservatism. Of a somewhat different character, though in the same broad category, is James Joyce, born in 1882 in an Ireland still under British rule, but in a culture steeped in Catholicism. Indeed, though through the Jesuit schools he attended, Joyce experienced a Catholic intellectual and spiritual formation of a particularly powerful form. For him, as a young man, therefore, rebellion meant rebellion against the Church. Artistic modernism was a way of making a decisive break from a status quo understood in terms of everything he regarded as bad about Catholicism. These experiences, however, were far from typical. Most people in Europe and America were not living in a world defined by the Church. The crisis of modernity was about the wrenching changes created by urbanization, industrialization, secularization, and migration, and the horrors of war. Eric Tunning summarizes the view of another scholar Roger Griffin, defining modernism, and I quote, "a revolt against a late 19th century modernity, increasingly constructed by artists and intellectuals, and after the First World War, by much of the broader public, radicalized by unprecedented carnage in Europe as decadence," unquote. Whereas for theological modernists and anti-Catholic artists like Joyce, modernism looks like the embrace of modernity and the rejection of tradition, others understood it as a revolt against modernity. This may, and as we shall see often did, take on the form of a counter-revolution, an effort to restore aspects of pre-modernity. Certainly, these artists joined in the rejection of the artistic forms of the previous era, but for them, this was a project of stripping away conventions associated with modernity. The connection is easiest to see by reference to mass production for the new middle classes of the late 19th century. Characterized by bad art, seasoned with sentimentality. It might be an idea to close that door. Rejecting modernity could then be a way to create space for an older and more authentic tradition, like Gill's reconnection with the medieval artistic tradition. An amusing example of this is the work of the petition signatory Giorgio de Chirico, an Italian artist who signed the 1971 petition. He more or less invented surrealism. If you Google him, that's what comes up. But he repented of surrealism in 1919 and took up in later life a more classical style. He even made fun of the critics and collectors enamoured of his earlier work by producing his own fakes. Works which are presumably artistically insincere, which present themselves as having been made in his earlier period. We might read this as a caustic comment on critics' gullibility and how modern art, at least in some genres, can be technically unchallenging. It is too easy and thus incapable of carrying profound meaning. It is a kind, rather, of anti-art, a rejection of the artistic endeavour. This, indeed, is a message of a kind and one necessarily implied by the critical exaltation of art, which is simply bad. Others, however, rebelled against modernity while continuing to use modernist artistic styles. One example of this is the poet E.E. Cummings, American poet, famous for his eccentric use of capitalization. In his poet, Jehovah Buried, Satan Dead, which itself, I can't, of course, express the way that those words don't really work in the way that you'd normally expect them to look on the page. The target for his polemic is the mass-produced, amoral conformity of the modern world. And I quote, "fearers worship much and quick." Another quote, "gadgets murder, squawk and ad. The cult of same is all the chic. Hates a game and loves a phi upsilon kappa." The final stanza of his poem still comes as a shock. "King Christ, this world is all a leak, and life preservers there are none, and waves which only he can walk, who dares to call himself a man." In a similar way, the Four Quartets, written after T.S. Eliot's conversion, is a profoundly Christian poem, a modernist work of art at once technically brilliant, beautiful, and the expression of traditional spiritual values. It represents Eliot's solution to the problem of modernity, which was expressed in pessimistic terms in Proof Rock, and then in a more complete way in The Wasteland. Some of Eliot's modernist artistic friends were appalled to read these lines of the Four Quartets, which refer to Jesus Christ. "The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands, we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart." A parallel can be drawn with Sir James Macmillan's Christmas Oratorio, commissioned and performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, which I saw in the UK premiere in 2021. The oratorio sets to music passages of Milton, the recusant Catholic poet-priest St. Robert Southwell, A Scottish Lullaby, The Preface of St. John's Gospel, and Latin Liturgical Texts. Like Eliot, Macmillan seeks to express a traditional Christian faith through art which is modernist in terms of style. Like Eliot, he understands and makes use of traditional forms, but goes beyond them and breathes new life into them with modern forms and conventions. In Eliot's words, an easy commerce of the old and the new. Although modernism tends not to be applied to political movements, this way of looking at modernism as a phenomenon would enable us to include under it communism and fascism, which in slightly different ways embrace industrialization, reject bourgeois morality, and seek new forms of solidarity to replace those which had been destroyed with the older feudal and religious order. I talk about this more in chapter 10. Similarly, Chesterton and Belloc's theory of distributivism and the Back to the Land movement, which came up with other solutions to the same problems, could be regarded as part of modernism, as clearly are their artistic allies among the followers of Ruskin and members of Eric Gill's Ditchling community, including David Jones. These competing modernisms become personified in the poem series Horae Canonicae by the modernist poet Auden, who's also a high Anglican and signed the 1966 petition. The canonical hours provide the structure of the series, each of the seven poems being named after successive diurnal hours from prime to lords. The subject of the series is the redemption, and in its centre is an extraordinary evocation of the crucifixion, which contrives not to refer to it by name or explicit description, but mainly by the time of its occurrence between sexed and known. And I quote, "What happened today between a noon and three? At this noon on this hill, in the occasion of this dying." In Vespers, Auden imagines himself confronted by Utopian, a revolutionary whose ideal he names New Jerusalem, while he himself is an Arcadian longing for return to Eden. And I quote, "So these are the two kinds of modernism which become personified in Auden's poems. So the revolutionary, the kind of communist or fascist or something like that, and him, the Arcadian, the artist. In my Eden, a person who dislikes Bellini has the good manners not to get born. In his New Jerusalem, a person who dislikes work will be very sorry he was born. In my Eden, we have a few beam engines, saddle tank locomotives, overshot water wheels, and other beautiful pieces of obsolete machinery to play with. In his Jerusalem, even chefs will be cucumber-cool machine minders. In my Eden, each observes his compulsive rituals and superstitious taboos, but we have no morals. In his New Jerusalem, the temples will be empty, but all will practice the rational virtues." Auden sees the revolutionary's point of view as necessary, a corrective against aestheticism. And I quote again, "forcing us both for a fraction of a second to remember our victim. But for him, I could forget the blood. But for me, he could forget the innocence." The poem series concludes with the dawn mass bell, which connects the individual's devotion to the fate of the community with a repeated italicised line, "in solitude for company." These competing understandings of modernism point to a far more complex and nuanced picture than first appeared. The term modernism is indelibly associated, especially for Catholics, with the theological movement that sought to overturn theological and liturgical tradition as inadequate to the demands of modernity. A movement combated by Pope Pius X and in some ways vindicated following the Second Vatican Council. As noted elsewhere, in fact in chapter 14, the perspective of those outside the church's clerical establishment is usually rather different. Artists with an interest in religion who adopted modernist forms in the course of the 20th century could do so for the same reason that an earlier generation of Christian artists had revived medieval techniques to repudiate the regimentation and mass production of industrial society. The ancient Catholic Mass is a remarkable pre-modern survival in the modern world. From a spiritual point of view, those able to experience it at the centre of a Catholic community in the mid-20th century and indeed since then, were able to witness not something like an ancient building inhabited by modern people, so much as an ancient village with its bustling denizens in the middle of a modern city. It was not simply a piece of art from another era, but a form of life, a spirituality, with the power to transform those who engaged with it, utterly at odds with the soul-crushing conditions of modernity. For the modernist artist, sick of chocolate box art, conventional, stale, and sentimental, this liturgy was not part of what needed to be overthrown, but an ally of incomparable power. This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.